With the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza now close to entering its sixth month, the death toll surpasses 30,200, majority of them women and children. Israel conducts a drone attack on a car on a road used by the UN interim force in Lebanon, killing three people. And following Iranian elections for parliament and the assembly of experts, attention now focuses on the outcome as vote counting is underway. Now more Palestinians have lost their lives as Israel continues ahead with its genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip, now in its 148th day. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, at least 92 Palestinians were killed and 156 others injured over the past 24 hours. At least 17 people were killed in attacks on Deir el-Balah and the Jabalia refugee camp just today. The ministry says many people are still trapped under rubble as rescuers are unable to reach them. A day ago, at least 10 children were reportedly died from malnutrition and dehydration in the same city. Death toll from Israel's relentless onslaught on Gaza since early October has surpassed 30,300, most of them women and children, and more than 71,500 Palestinians have also been injured, while thousands more remain unaccounted for. Israel continues to use starvation as an instrument of war against Palestinians in Gaza, while also intensifying airstrikes on the besieged enclave. Our correspondent joined us earlier from Deir el-Balah with more.
In the meantime, it's worth mentioning that the Israeli occupation forces are still using starvation as a weapon of war against the Palestinian people, taking more lives of the Palestinian children in Gaza Strip. The number of the Palestinian children who have been killed since the over the last couple of days actually amounted to 13 Palestinian children. 13 Palestinian children were killed in a cold blood by the Israeli occupation forces as they were deprived of having the food and clean drinkable water, causing them a malnutrition and a dehydration. And this number is highly expected to rise exponentially as thousands of the Palestinian children are living the same circumstances of deprivation of the needed humanitarian needs and assistance and the needed medical care. We are talking about catastrophic and beyond catastrophic humanitarian conditions. The need for the people here is very dire. And having this sporadic humanitarian aid allowed into Gaza or dropped in, on Gaza Strip actually means nothing compared to the dire need that the Palestinian people are living and experiencing, particularly when it comes to the children. What Gaza Strip really needs these moments is the flow, the continuous flow of the humanitarian aid into Gaza Strip. And this actually needs a real political willingness from the regional parties. They need to oblige the Israeli occupation to allow the entry of those humanitarian aid into Gaza Strip without having any restrictions. The Israeli occupation forces committed a telling massacre over the last night here in Deir el-Balah city, after destroying and targeting at least the three residential buildings at the center of Deir el-Balah and in the eastern part of Deir el-Balah, claiming the lives of at least 22 Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children. They were attacked and killed as they were sleeping inside their houses.
And intense battles are also underway on the ground in Gaza, with Palestinian fighters repelling attacks by Israeli forces. The military wing of Islamic Jihad released video showing its fighters clashing with Israeli soldiers in and around the Al-Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City. The Al-Quds brigades also launched mortar shells at a gathering of regime soldiers in northern Gaza. Also in the north, Mujahideen brigades hit a Merkava tank with missiles. Resistance groups also said they shot down an Israeli drone over the southeastern part of Gaza. Tel Aviv says a total of 242 Israeli soldiers have been killed since ground fighting began in late October in Gaza. Palestinian resistance groups, however, say Israel is concealing the actual number, which is much higher. The United Nations says that many of the victims of a deadly food convoy attack in Gaza City had gunshot wounds, and that's despite Israeli claims that the incident was a stampede. Spokesman for the UN Secretary General says gunshot wounds have been confirmed by a UN team during a visit to Al-Shifa Hospital, where many of the victims were taken. Stéphane Dujarric's comments echo those by director of Al-Auda Hospital in Jabalia. Mohamed Salah earlier said 142 of the 176 victims of Thursday's incident taken to the hospital had gunshot wounds. Eyewitnesses also said that Israeli soldiers opened fire on starving Palestinians who were waiting for aid. Attack left 112 people dead and hundreds wounded. And there seems to be no end in sight to Israeli deadly raids on the occupied West Bank. A Palestinian teenager is the latest victim of an attack near the city of Ramallah. According to the Palestinian news agency, Mohammed Aldi was shot in the head during an Israeli attack on the town of Kafr Ni'mah. Regime forces also raided the cities of Qalqilya, Al-Khalil, and Azun. In Qalqilya, a Palestinian was abducted after locals resisted a raid on their city. Israel's intensified its incursions across the West Bank since launching its genocidal war on Gaza. Attacks by Israel's forces and settlers have left more than 400 Palestinians dead in occupied territory since early October. And three people have been killed in an Israeli drone strike targeting a vehicle in the city of Nakuta in southern Lebanon. Attack on a car on a road used by the UN interim force is the latest in a spate of Israel's aerial strikes on southern Lebanon. Meanwhile, the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says it struck an Israeli command center in northern occupied territories using a kamikaze drone. Hezbollah and Israel have been engaged in exchanges of fire since the regime launched its genocidal campaign on Gaza. Lebanese resistance fighters have mainly targeted Israeli military positions, but the Israeli regime's even targeted residential areas in Lebanon, causing deaths of civilians. More Lebanese have lost their lives as Israeli airstrikes once again target residential area in southern Lebanon. Mariam Saleh joined us earlier from Beirut with the details.
Well, you mentioned, Daniel, the car that was struck by three, at least, rockets from a drone, from an Israeli drone. The Israelis say they killed three people in that car. We still don't have official confirmation either from Hezbollah or any official side here in Lebanon to confirm the number of the martyrs and if they were Hezbollah members or civilians. We were told that there were no civilians in that car. But in addition to that strike, the Israelis have launched several airstrikes in the area of Labmune, which is near Nakura, and that car specifically was targeted. We also have other Israeli shelling in the towns of Tayr Harfa and Wazani. They have been also heavily bombarded, but the heaviest shelling that occurred was yesterday, and at least 50% of Israel's assaults yesterday were conducted through aerial strikes through their war jets. There was a lot of destruction in the town of Ramya. Several houses, civilian houses, were destroyed. Hezbollah, in one of those strikes, says that they lost four Hezbollah members, and they have, of course, declared the names of those Hezbollah fighters. Hezbollah has also declared that they had launched in one of the areas, which is in Liman. This is considered a newly recent post that has been put forth by the Israelis in the area of Liman. Hezbollah said it targeted it with a kamikaze drone, and it struck its target very precisely. And when you say a recent post, that means that the Israelis are basically moving away from many of those posts that are on the border, since they have been targeted many times by Hezbollah, and therefore trying to situate themselves in areas that are further from the border. They're creating new makeshift posts, and so that is proof that Hezbollah has been very efficient when it comes to targeting their posts.
Iran's president is in the Algerian capital to attend a summit of gas exporting countries forum. Ibrahim Raisi was welcomed by the Algerian prime minister upon arrival in Algiers. Raisi then met with his Algerian counterpart, Abdelmadjid Tebboune, before start of the summit. A North African country is hosting the seventh summit of heads of state and government of the GECF. of forms comprised of 11 member states and 8 observer states. And now vote counting is underway in Iran for Friday's elections that will determine the fate of the next parliament and assembly of experts. The process of vote tallying kicked off soon after polls closed following the extension of voting hours 3 times. Iran's election commissions announced the winners in some of the constituencies. The voter turnout in the elections is set to be at over 41%, which means 25 million people out of more than 61 million eligible voters took part in the balloting. Over 15,000 candidates are vying for 290 seats in parliament. Hundreds of candidates are also in the race for 88-seat Assembly of Experts, which is a deliberative body elected for 8 years. Iranian voters have expressed the unwavering support for Islamic revolution by actively participating in the elections. Iranians say they deeply believe in the power of their collective voice and democratic processes in the Islamic Republic. Let's listen to what some of them had to say.
With our votes, we want to show that despite problems and deficiencies in the country's governance, the people are wholeheartedly supporting the revolution, their national interests, and their country.
We have to fulfill our duty to the extent we can. Yes, there are many problems, too many problems. We're sad and we voice our criticism as much as we can. God willing, those responsible will think about them and probably many of them do care.
I feel that the participation is much better than last time and in my opinion, people are optimistic about the elections.
With all the propaganda that hostile media made, I think the turnout would be higher than the previous round.
Iran's Constitutional Council has the important role of overseeing the electoral process and confirming the final results of the elections. Our correspondent Gisu Misha Ahmadi earlier talked to the spokesperson of the very council at a polling station in Tehran.
We've witnessed the voting of our people from the very early hours. And as you can see, in midday, we see such great crowds here. And this shows that people deem it important to use their right. The future of the country is important to them. The future of themselves and their children are important to them. Thank God there's been no problem since the beginning of voting and everything has been smooth and facilitated and people are casting their ballots in the two parliamentary elections and the Assembly of Experts elections. Since the morning, we've been overseeing the elections. We have not seen any special irregularity since the morning. And some minor issues have been removed. We have not had any special problem. As well as the 230,000 public supervisors, we have also introduced a system so that all the 80 million population of Iran can supervise the election. So if there is any potential irregularity, they could document it for us.
U.S. military has carried out fresh airstrikes on Yemen to put pressure on the Arab country to stop its anti-Israel operations in the Red Sea. U.S. Central Command said in a statement that raids are targeting air defense systems of Yemen, and that followed an earlier statement by CENTCOM that a U.S. flagship was targeted with a ballistic missile in the Red Sea. The U.S. and U.K. have conducted a number of airstrikes on Yemen to stop Yemenis from their naval blockade on the Israeli regime. Yemeni armed forces launched their operations against Israel-linked ships over the regime's genocide in Gaza. But over the past month, Yemenis have intensified attacks on U.S. and British ships as well in retaliation for the two countries' aggression against the Arab country. It's election year in the UK, and the ongoing Israeli genocidal war on Gaza has taken center stage in special electoral campaigns in England this month. Saeed Pirza reports on by-elections in the greater Manchester town of Rochdale, where the opposition Labour Party's failure to call for a ceasefire in Gaza has now come home to roost.
Once a boomtown of the Industrial Revolution, Rochdale in northwest England has been reliably Labour for years. Until now. This was an election that saw allegations of fraud, desperate attempts like this one by the right-wing Reform Party.
Make sure you prevent George Galloway from being your MP for Rochdale.
And dominated by the massacre in Gaza.
From the river to the sea.
The result came hours after polls closed.
Hereby declare that George Galloway is duly elected.
A sweeping victory for a veteran anti-war pro-Palestine campaigner who reminded everyone that the anger in Britain over the Gaza genocide is not confined to the Muslim community only.
Every Muslim is bitterly angry at Keir Starmer and his misnamed Labour Party. But you would be very foolish if you did not realize that millions of other citizens of our country are.
Rochdale is home to a 30,000-strong Muslim community.
George Galloway for Rochdale.
Apart from bread and butter issues such as the declining public services, unemployment, poverty and crime that have racked the constituency for years, for the majority of the voters here, there was more to take into account.
This is a blessing to basically take our word straight to Parliament, and if one person just goes in there and asks for a ceasefire, asks for all these genocide to stop, it's more than any Labour candidate or Labour MP or anyone has done for many years.
He can bring change to us locally, but also nationally and internationally. So the thing is, the ongoing issue with Gaza is a big issue, and it's an international issue. But at the same time, it's not just a Muslim issue. It's about human rights.
The election was triggered by the death in January of opposition Labour Party MP Tony Lloyd. He was replaced by this man, Azhar Ali. On voting day, though, Labour's campaign centre lay shuttered after the party abandoned Ali for making anti-Israel remarks.
By-elections don't always represent the wider national picture. They are protest votes with a local focus. Last time around, Labour won the seat here by 10,000 votes, but this time they lost. And perhaps that is a sign of what's to come, both for Labour and the Conservatives, with the general elections only months away. Saipur is up, Rochdale, Greater Manchester.
That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Watcher.
Dow Chemical and DuPont are American chemical corporations. These two chemical giants have become the number one companies in the chemical sector. Today, they make billions of euros in profit, but behind this resounding success lies a dark secret: toxic contamination and pollution, which has affected thousands, causing disabilities, cancers, and even death. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For decades, Dow Chemical and DuPont factories have been secretly dumping their toxic waste into rivers, groundwater systems, and soil, and keeping the tragic consequences a secret. Sadly, the constant exposure to toxic waste spares no one, neither surrounding residents nor the company's employees. Stay with us as this week's documentary sheds light over years of lies and impunity through the analysis of samples in confidential documents.
Be up in there, keep an eye, get out of the head.
At the end of the 60s, Leotis Jones was a prisoner in Holmesburg, a suburb of Philadelphia in the United States. A prisoner, but also a guinea pig for industry, like thousands of other inmates.
H-Block, this is where all the medical testing, the human experimentation was going on.
How many times have you taken that corridor?
Oh, man, about maybe 25, 30 times. You know, but there was different tests that they was running. And sometimes I was on, like, two tests at a time, you know?
Okay.
This practice was confidential at the time because multinational chemical companies came here to test the risks of their products. To earn a few dollars, the prisoners participated in several tests, but none of them knew what they were being given.
What they would do, they would put the tape and stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it. Then they would put a drop in the substance, whatever it was that was in it, on that area.
And what happened after?
All over my body, my skin pigmentation got light in certain areas.
How long did it last?
About a year, somewhere around there. And they had you signing a paper stating that it was informed consent, but it was just a paper to waive them from being liable if anything go wrong.
One company did everything they could to keep this a secret. They even paid Leotis Jones for his silence. Dow Chemical. The leading manufacturer of plastics in the world and the third largest manufacturer of pesticides, Dow Chemical has an annual turnover of $48 billion and 50,000 employees around the globe. In the wake of this chemical giant, there's an industry of staggering profitability, an industry in a frantic race to innovate. Each year, their new toxic products reach the market. These multinationals all have one thing in common: a culture of secrecy.
They're following us.
Polluting lands, rivers, and groundwater. Behind the fumes of these factories, we have discovered tens of thousands of victims. In India, children are born with severe disabilities. In the U.S., those who have dedicated their lives to this industry.
Everybody wanted to go there because for the money, for the benefits, and it was secure.
Are now paying the price.
Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. Why'd they lie?
Faced with these tragedies, the chemical giants have adopted a specific course of action: lack of transparency, cynicism, denial. In the meantime, they continue to reap the profits. In Holmesburg Prison, Dow experimented on the inmates with one of the most carcinogenic products in the world, dioxin. It's one of the molecules in Agent Orange, the powerful herbicide that Dow produced for the American Army during the Vietnam War. The Air Force dumped it on the Viet Cong for a decade. At the same time, the tests were being performed at Holmesburg. From that time on, Dow was already aware of the dangers of dioxin. The company put it in writing in this confidential note from June 1965. Dioxin is exceptionally toxic. Some months later, Dow would study its side effects on the prisoners.
Hey, man, what can I say? There's no way in the world if they would have informed us back then that we would participate. No. No, no, I wouldn't have. They were trying to cover it up. They wouldn't have made it now.
We found one of the doctors that performed the tests at Holmesburg in the 1960s. Today, he's an oncologist at Northwestern Hospital in Chicago. Sigmund Weitzman is preparing to retire. He is one of the few witnesses still alive.
Every day, I had a row of 20 convicts. They were coming in all day. Okay. So
all day long, people were coming in?
Oh, absolutely. It was a machine.
In 1967, Sigmund Weitzman was only 21 years old. He was an intern at Holmesburg. The senior physician overseeing the tests never told him the names of the products used on the prisoners. He only realized later that he had administered dioxin to human beings. We show him what Dow knew back then about the chemical.
This material is exceptionally toxic. No wonder it's confidential. This is 50 years old.
Yeah.
It's very upsetting.
This is the first time you read these documents?
Yes.
I'm
appalled. I'm just very... It's so casual. I also felt personally guilty that I was participating in something so horrible. You don't give people poison. It's just simple. You know, as if these people aren't people. They're just experimental animals. Nowadays, it would be criminal.
Dow was never prosecuted. When prisoners tried to take action against the company, the statute of limitations had expired. This multinational would not only poison inmates with dioxin, but also tens of thousands of people in Midland, Michigan, in the north of the U.S. Midland, the birthplace of Dow.
Here at the Dow Chemical Company in Midland, Michigan, revolutionary chemical killers.
This is where Agent Orange was manufactured. Its production created waste extremely high in dioxin. Dow secretly dumped this waste into the river that flows through the city. In 1981, one man would discover the truth.
We had a conclusion there that Dow was a major source, if not the only source, to the river, and certainly to the community, and that people were at risk.
At the time, Milton Clark was a toxicologist for the EPA, the government agency responsible for environmental protection. With his colleagues, he wrote a report condemning Dow's practices. But right before the report's publication, the corporation would succeed in pressuring the acting chief of the EPA in Washington. Pressured by his superiors, Milton Clark was forced to censor the report. The result? Pollution in Midland, Michigan would continue for 30 years with impunity. And the executives at Dow would continue denying the dangers.
There is no health problem in Midland. There is absolutely no evidence of dioxin doing any damage to humans.
In 2006, one woman would attack the multinational again. At the time, Mary Gade oversaw all the offices at the Environmental Agency in the Midland region. She had leverage. She'd been nominated by the President of the United States, George W. Bush. Newly appointed, she demands that more testing be done in the city.
We found these astronomically high levels of dioxin, levels that my staff think may be some of the highest levels ever found in the United States. One of the things that was astonishing to me when this came to my attention was that for almost 30 years, this very serious problem had not actually been addressed.
Where have you found these high levels?
So yeah, we found that in yards alongside the river system, parks where children play, where people launch their boats, where fishermen put their boats in the water. This is where people live. So I immediately called Dow senior officials and said, we're very concerned about these levels. We need you to take action. As that unfolded, the company was not happy. It's extremely expensive to clean up this much contamination, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more.
To lodge a complaint, Dow goes directly to the White House.
I was asked on May 1st of 2008 to either resign or quit by the end of the day.
Okay. Were you surprised?
Yes, very much so. In my 30-some years of working in environmental protection and much of that spent in the government, I would have never expected that. Dow was acting in its own interests, so Dow was trying to make sure that it saved as much money as possible.
As a result of these maneuvers, for decades, thousands of people have lived surrounded by dioxin without knowing the risks. We wanted to meet these victims. But in Midland, it's hard to loosen tongues. Dow has supported the city for 120 years, and reminders are at every corner. At the bank, the stadium, the library, the public park, the high school. The shadow of the company is everywhere. Only one person agreed to break the code of silence. Alice Buchelter has spent most of her life here, near the river. This is where she raised her family.
We used to have all trails that went down through here. The land is very fertile, and it was used for motocross trails and hiking trails and dune buggy trails and just, you know, recreation in the woods. For a kid, it was like a wonderland. It was, you know, an adventure. They could explore and they could build forts and they could do all those things.
No one advised you that there was dioxin down there?
Nope. We just thought we found a magical spot for us to play and raise a family.
For nearly 40 years, the Buchelter family would live here, blissfully unaware of their toxic surroundings. Every spring, the river floods their garden, bringing in a fresh wave of dioxin. Alice Buchelter would not discover the true extent of the contamination until 2007, when tests were conducted in her garden by the local environmental agency. The levels of dioxin were up to 17 times higher than the legal limit for toxicity.
My oldest daughter has autoimmune diseases.
You have 5 kids?
Mm-hmm.
How many of them do have autoimmune disease?
I would say all of them. Some to a lesser degree and some to a more severe degree. And my husband had a very malignant colon cancer. It was a real quick onset.
Her late husband, Herbert Buchelter, was a doctor. A few days before he passed away, he expressed a last wish.
He was brave enough to, when he was dying, to have his blood drawn when he didn't have very much blood left. Dioxin levels were taken the Thursday before he died on a Sunday. He was willing to do it to ascertain that there was a connection. The results of my husband's, this is his levels.
These are the actual breakdown.
Alex Buchelter's husband had 64.5 nanograms of dioxin per liter of blood, 3 times the U.S. average.
We We had been married 46 years when he died. And would I have treasured 10 more years? Yeah. And, you know, that's been a major impact on my life.
The American Environmental Agency has finally forced Dow to clean the river. But the process has only just begun. It could take decades and cost hundreds of millions of dollars. However, no date is set for decontaminating neighboring yards, like Alice Buchelter's. Dow refused all our requests for an interview. The multinational merely sent us an email stating that we seek science-based solutions that protect human health while also contributing to the well-being of the local community. On the other side of the world, another contamination is wreaking havoc. As a result of one of the worst industrial catastrophes in history, thousands of children have been affected. But Dow has never dealt with it. It happened in India, in Bhopal. In 1984, the local chemical plant exploded, killing 20,000 people and releasing tons of toxic products. At the time, the factory belonged to Union Carbide, a pesticide giant that Dow would buy up in 2001. The site of the Bhopal explosion is still saturated with chemical pollution. Over the years, these products have spread into the city's groundwater systems. For 15 years, the inhabitants have demanded a full decontamination. In vain, Dow refuses to act. The decaying steel site is still accessible today. Here we meet Mr. Shuan, a former engineer. At the time, he was in charge of the storage of the chemicals in this laboratory.
There's so many chemicals still remaining in this quality control lab. Very few bottles are now at present. But after the disaster, this quality control lab was full of the chemicals, bottle, drums. And after 32 years, still they are lying.
Is that dangerous?
Yeah, it is dangerous because there's no proper care of these premises.
Among the products stored in the factory, there was lindane, an extremely toxic insecticide. Today it is forbidden all over the world. According to our guide, the soil surrounding the factory is full of it.
The whole area is highly contaminated. They are dumping all toxic waste effluent on the ground. Right now you can feel the smell of the benzene hexachloride on this spot. And it is dangerous to stay here for a long period.
Benzene hexachloride is the scientific name for lindane. We go down to the area of the spill to take some samples. The smell is unbearable. We'll have the soil analyzed. Just before leaving, Mr. Schwan shows us where the pesticides were made. Beads of mercury lie exposed in the open air. According to the World Health Organization, this is one of the top 10 most dangerous chemical products in the world. We take some more samples. The results of our two tests are astonishing. Inside the factory, the level of mercury is 5 million times higher than the environmental standard. At this level of concentration, the risks of developing liver, skin, or lung cancers are considerable. The levels of lindane are just as alarming, exceeding 100,000 times the standard level. This can provoke severe cases of cerebral degeneration. Yet only 20 meters away, we see children playing cricket on the contaminated ground. The chemical contamination stretches far beyond the walls of the factory. Toxic waste has penetrated the land and has polluted the water of many neighborhoods. Up to 3 kilometers from the factory, 50,000 people live there. We went to take water samples to identify the molecules present in their wells. Like in Shakya's family home, they've lived in this house for almost 30 years. The water they consume contains 1.9 micrograms of mercury per liter, two times the standard level of toxicity. The problem is, even in boiled water, mercury is still carcinogenic. In other areas of Bhopal, it's not mercury, but lindane that wreaks havoc on human lives. This is a problem in Preetnagar, a neighborhood situated 1 kilometer away from the factory. The municipality has had drinkable water since 2011, but for many years, the inhabitants have been drinking severely polluted water. That's the case for Rukmani and her 13-year-old daughter, Rachna. Since her birth, she's suffered from limited mental development and muscular dystrophy. She can neither talk nor stand up by herself. Rukmani, her mother, drank contaminated water every day during her pregnancy. A few months after Rachna's birth, a governmental study was conducted in the area. The levels of lindane were extremely high in the water, 17 times the World Health Organization limit. Due to her disabilities, Rachna has never been able to go to school. Every day she comes to the Shingari Rehabilitation Center. Without these daily exercises, she would be completely paralyzed today. Rashida B. is the founder of the center. She has watched all these children grow up.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. And this is your host, Brother Mustafa. On this show, we discuss Islamic ethics and morality and what steps we can take towards reaching God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So the first topic that I want to start off talking about, one of the first steps that we can potentially take towards reaching God, is actually just correcting our way of thinking and our thoughts. This is a piece of advice that's also written in different books. For example, it's written in a book by Ayatollah Dastaghib Shirazi, and it's a book on Islamic ethics. And by the way, Ayatollah Dastaghib Shirazi, he's one of our prominent and very important scholars from the Islamic Shia world. He has written many, many significant books. For example, he's written one of his most popular books is Greater Sins, which is I would highly recommend people reading if they want to learn more about Islamic ethics. And one of the advices that he gives and also many other scholars give is related to our way of thinking. What is our understanding, or what are our thoughts about spirituality, about God, about how we can reach God? Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Yeah, Allah, yeah, Allah, be with me all the way. Yeah. Now, I'm studying psychology here in Hausa. And one of the things that we talk about in psychology, especially when we're doing therapy of people who need help, is correcting their way of thinking, right? Many times, the way we understand a topic, it may be incorrect, it may have shortcomings, and if we have an incorrect thinking about a certain topic, then that impacts how we feel about it, and then it ultimately impacts how we behave, and it affects our behavior. So, what is exactly Islamic spirituality, and what should we really know about it, right? What it is and what it's not. Because in today's world, one of the issues that we have is that there is this idea that spirituality is, for example, you know, sitting down and doing meditation, or it's about, you know, opening our chakras, or it's about, you know, gaining some kind of universal energy, for example. These are all things that if we go online on YouTube, we find personalities, different personalities that talk about, you know, spirituality. It may sometimes be correct, it may not always be correct. So what I want to emphasize on is please spend time on learning Islamic spirituality. Many times we go into other areas and we don't always necessarily understand, you know, what it's about. Another example, for example, that I can give, sometimes people think Islamic spirituality is about opening our, for example, our barzakhi, our spiritual eyes, so that we can see things from the unseen. And definitely we find things like this, you know, in Islamic literature. But it's definitely not the purpose behind Islamic spirituality. And the purpose, I believe, that my understanding that I have about Islamic spirituality is actually reaching and connecting to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, is recognizing God through His signs, right? And that's the main purpose, that you don't necessarily have to be able to see the unseen or... for example, we hear about people performing miracles. These are definitely not among the purposes or the goals of Islamic spirituality. We have to go for a break, and once we come back from the break, I'll talk a little bit more about this.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. Your love is all I need. It's all I need. Your love is all I need. It's all I need. Your love is all I need. All I need. Your love is all I need. Oh.
All I need to be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me. 'Cause your love is all I need to be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me. 'Cause your love is all I need to be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Your love is all I need.
So we're back from the break, and the topic we're discussing, the very first step towards reaching God in Islamic spirituality, is understanding our thinking about God. And what I am recommending, what my understanding is from what I've read about Islamic spirituality, the purpose is to connect to God, to understand Him through His signs. When we turn to the Quran, the Holy Quran, we find repeatedly in so many verses, God says, those people who understand, those who think, you know, they look at our signs. For example, He says, they look at the sunrise and the sunset. They look at creation, and through that, they come to an understanding about God. This is something that I think we all read, and we sometimes maybe don't really place a lot of emphasis on because of how many times it is actually repeated in the Quran. However, because it's repeated so many times, we do need to place a lot of emphasis on this. God is constantly telling us to think and ponder in the Quran. He's telling us to look at His signs. So the purpose of Islamic spirituality is to understand God through all of the signs that He sends us. And those are signs in the natural universe. Those are signs that we have within us. Those are the signs in the Quran itself and through our prophets and imams. So our understanding of who God is and our way of connecting to Him has to come through these means. Another way of thinking about reaching God is to understand that we are all searching for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Every single human being that's born, he or she is searching for God. And what do I mean? Even the atheist, I would say, is in a way searching for God. The only difference is that sometimes people's search for perfection becomes very limited. They search for perfection or they search for knowledge in extremely limited things. For example, a scientist studying the human cell is also studying one of the signs of God, because every single thing that exists that is in creation is a sign of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And you know, if a scientist limits him or herself to the cell and they spend their entire life searching for it and studying it, they're still studying a sign of God without really knowing it. Or in another way I can put it is that we all feel that there's something missing inside of us, right? We all feel, for example, you'll hear people say, I feel like there's a hole inside me. And we all search for meaning. The direction of this search sometimes, again, becomes limited. For example, we may start searching for meaning through very worldly things. For example, through money. For example, through buying houses or in other people. Or it could be, you know, in clothes, in fashion. And the people that do this, they still want to be perfect, right? They still are searching for that one perfect thing. However, everything in this world that exists, that we have in front of us, we know that it will perish. We ourselves, our bodies will perish, and what we own and what we have will also perish. God says in the Holy Quran, the only thing remaining will be Himself. He uses the word, His face will be the only thing, that, for example, that will be remaining. Which again points to the fact that He is the only permanent thing that we must be searching for. And He is the only permanent thing which can permanently fill that void or hole that we feel. Everything else is temporary and can only temporarily fill that need of ours. So that's all the time we have for today's episode. Inshallah, I hope you continue listening to the rest of these episodes. And please pray for me and for yourself that God helps and guides us so that we can reach Him and understand what spirituality is in the most correct manner. Thank you so much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, He knows. Allah knows.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.